Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live alternate Wednesdays now at the very early bird time of 8:30 p.m. Tonight's episode, February 22nd, 2012, is titled Growing Through Grief. My guest and co-host is Ashley Davis Bush, a psychotherapist at Transitions and Loss Counseling and Couples Connect in Epping, New Hampshire, contributing writer at the Huffington Post, and author of the best-selling Transcending Loss and Shortcuts to Inner Peace. Together, we'll be discussing how loss can be the springboard for transformative change. This is a very compelling topic. I've really been looking forward to talking about this because it comes up all the time in my work with my clients. But before I bring Ashley on the air, first, one brief technical issue. Your toll-free call-in number is 877-497-9046 in case you get disconnected or you forgot. All callers will be muted unless you have a question or a comment, in which case just press the 1 key on your phone and you'll be online to join us live on the air. So, hi, Ashley.
Hello. Hi, Susan. It's great to be here with you tonight.
Oh, I've been so looking forward to this because this is, you know, you've written the book and more than one book, but you are the expert on this subject. And this subject about loss is something that is pervasive in my work with clients. So I'm just loaded with stuff that I'd like to talk to you about. And hopefully we can pack it all in a very brief, less than an hour. Now, one thing I was thinking about, Ashley, it sounds like you're okay with letting people ask questions as we go, unless there are a lot of questions, in which case we would just hold them to till certain intervals of time.
Yes, absolutely. Whatever seems to make sense. I'm flexible.
Okay, that's great, because my experience is if we ask people to wait until the very end, you know, sometimes they have to leave or they may forget. Or the subject changes and they're into another issue that's more compelling for them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Ashley, you have written, you're best known for your book Transcending Loss, and you're very famous in this area for your work on loss and grieving with individuals and couples. And I'm just wondering, and I've often thought about this, I'm happy to have the opportunity to ask you here, how did you get into this work in your psychotherapy practice and in your writing?
Right. Well, you know, it's one of those things that doesn't really make logical sense, but it was a calling. I don't know how to explain it in any other way. I was in graduate school. I was in my late 20s, and the very first client I ever had as a student in a family counseling center was a woman whose sister had been murdered. It was my very first client. Mm-hmm. And I thought I would be just, you know, terrified, but in fact, when I was with her, it felt so natural to hear her pain and so compelling for me to want to work with her. Something just clicked, and I thought, this is what I'm meant to do. This is what I'm on this planet to do. So it really was just some sort of higher calling. And in terms of the writing, I became really interested in the idea of what helps people turn a tragic or painful situation into growth. And I started researching it, basically. I just became kind of obsessed with the question, and the book just came through me. I mean, it sounds sort of mystical, but that's exactly how it felt.
Wow. Now, was this a graduate thesis? Did it start as a graduate thesis? Or
no,
you were just doing
didn't.
This out of your own interest?
Out of my own interest and this just sort of compulsion to try to understand human behavior and human resilience, because mm-hmm. I really deeply believe that our birthright is to be resilient and to be able to use the experiences that we encounter in this world and turn it into growth.
And so you became curious about, it sounds like, just the nature of grieving and why some people manage it and use it as such a transformative thing, and for other people they get so stalled by it or so stuck in it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so as I listened to people, as I started, I interviewed 50 people for that particular book, which came out 15 years ago at this point, and I was hearing some common threads. I was hearing sort of patterns that were repeating themselves amongst the people who I felt had transcended. And that is a word that I use to basically symbolize the idea of making meaning, but it also has to do with perspective, which I think is really key. That, you know, if you're on the top of a building, let's say, and transcending has this concept of getting higher than or getting above, and when you have that kind of perspective, like a bird's eye view, you see things that you can't see when you're up close. So the idea of transcendence has to do with gaining a bigger picture and seeing the loss as a piece in the puzzle of your life.
Okay, so it's a kind of making peace with it in terms of the bigger picture, a kind of meta view.
Yes, exactly, a meta view and sort of seeing how it leads to future growth.
Okay, now in your book Transcending Loss, you address the issue of the healthy lifelong nature of grief. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that and how you would define the difference between normal or healthy grief or not.
Great. I love to talk about this. And I think it's really an important topic because so many people misunderstand grief. And this is what I hear all the time. I run a Facebook site called Transcending Loss that has over 10,000 grievers on it, and they understand what the rest of the world doesn't, i.e. the non-grievers, which is that to a certain degree, grief never ends. Now, that's the good news and the bad news. It's bad news if you think that the pain is going to be severe and acute forever. That's not what it means. It means that you are impacted by the loss, that you are influenced and imprinted by this experience. In other words, there's no closure, quote unquote. A lot of people in this culture, we're a very pain-averse culture. We don't like pain. We don't want to feel sad. We don't like sorrow. We want to medicate it away. We want to drink it away, shop it away. You know, we have so many creative ways to avoid pain. And we want it to be over. Now, so this is what's really interesting is that, I mean, I'm sure any griever who's listening to this has been told at least one time on their journey, when are you going to be over this? When are you going to be your old self again? Or when will you find closure? And the answer is never, that this is a lifelong process, that you're now integrating this into who you are. Now, that can be healthy or unhealthy, however. An unhealthy aspect of having loss affect you for the rest of your life would mean that you stop growing, that you give up on love, that you shut down your heart, that you become bitter. That those are ways where the lifelong impact looks negative. The way that the lifelong impact looks positive or more healthy is when you decide this event happened and I'm going to make good from it. I'm going to grow from it. I'm going to touch other people through it. I'm going to take my pain and channel it in a way that creates something new in this world. So that's a very different way of looking at the lifelong impact. Basically, it's kind of the idea of when one door closes, another one opens. And, you know, that's a really key aspect to the healthy grief. But the underpinning of all of it is that it's not something that you're going to get over. It's something that you're going to have to learn to live with. The question is how.
Okay. And I would imagine people who hear that in your practice, people who read your book, and people who come to understand that you cannot go back to who you were before, you are forever transformed by this, experience some relief rather than thinking that I need to do just the right things, or there's this magical point in time when I'll be my old self again. I would imagine it's relieving.
There is a lot of relief, and there's a lot of sense of just validation because they're already experiencing it. But you know what? There's also sadness in that when you let go, or, you know, when something ends, there is undeniable sadness about that. And often people will say, but I want to be my old self again, or, you know, I liked that self and I liked that life, and yet that is over. That chapter has closed. And so it's both. It's this sense of sadness that you can't be the old self, and this sense you know that you're a different person now, and it's nice to have that validated.
Yeah. Now, this gets to one question that I hadn't anticipated. So this is a bit of a surprise question for you, but
okay, that's fine. I love surprise questions.
Now, what about the whole issue of in unhealthy grieving, when people shut down and they stop growing? You know, obviously there's got to be a changed worldview, a changed experience of the world as a more unpredictable, unsafe place. And I'm wondering, do you see any of that happening maybe in a temporary way, in a more temporary way around healthy grieving?
Absolutely. Oh, yes. Because really, the whole process of grieving, you don't just jump into this aspect of transcendence and, wow, you know, this terrible thing happened, let me make meaning out of it. That is really down the road. That comes over time. The first, I would say, several years of grieving are really a dark, dark place. For some people, it's less than a few years. For some people, depending on the nature of the loss, the trauma, the suddenness, the unexpectedness, if it was a child especially, it can be even longer than 2 years. And when I say dark, I mean people literally describe not being able to see color, not being able to feel any joy. In fact, having that bitterness. And yet, when they stay with it and when they see it as part of a process, it can and hopefully will start to shift. So I'm not too concerned in the beginning stages of grief if someone's in that incredibly dark place. In fact, I expect that, where there is a sense of bitterness and there is a sense of despair and maybe anger at God and anger at the world, and that's completely normal. But it's the stuck. If you get stuck there for, you know, more than a year, 6 months even, that's where I try to intervene and try to work with people to move them along. But it should be a process. It's not a linear process. It's often one step forward, two steps back, one another step forward, a few more steps back.
Okay.
And around a corner, and it's very nonlinear, and you just have to kind of ride this journey. It's unpredictable. It's different for every person. But when you allow the feelings to surface, when you really honor them and understand that it's all part of a fluid motion, then hopefully it's going to keep moving through.
Okay. Now, what would you see as the difference between grieving and depression? Because that's come up in my work where, you know, family members have called me because somebody looks depressed. And from my perspective, it clearly looks like someone's grieving the loss of a partner one way or another, or the loss of a child. And how would you make that distinction between grieving and depression?
Well, I would say people are pretty quick to want to identify it as depression, and then they want to treat it with medication. And again, this goes back to the sense that our culture, we don't like pain, we don't like change, we don't like to see people hurting. And yet, I would say probably 9 out of 10 times, it's just the normal grieving process. It's just someone in intense and severe pain. And that includes, by the way, even wanting to die, which is different than being suicidal. I would say almost all my clients who've gone through severe losses at some point have wanted to die. Basically, they want to go be with the person they love. But that, I don't consider that suicidality. I don't consider that depression. So I guess I'm saying I have a very high bar that because basically grief mimics depression. You feel terrible. You're in despair. You're in intense pain. You often have trouble eating. You have trouble sleeping. These are all symptoms of depression, and yet they're also symptoms of grief. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they need to be medicated away. In fact, I'm not even sure you can medicate them away. Mm-hmm. So for me, to diagnose depression has to do more with length of time and degree of severity. So when I say degree of severity, I mean that someone is so incapacitated that they can't work or they can't get out of bed. And I mean, you know, maybe if the loss has been more than a few months ago, because probably if it's only been a few weeks, not being able to get out of bed and not being able to function at work is completely normal. Mm-hmm. But after a few months, if that's still happening, severe weight loss or weight gain, if someone has insomnia to the point that they just can't sleep at all, you know, then I would say let's talk about medication, let's talk about various options for treating it. But mostly I would say depression comes in the length of time, and I would say pretty much over a year. Anything under a year I would call normal grieving.
Okay. I think there's so many misconceptions about that.
I know.
And I think you're right. Our culture, you know, I hear about other cultures like Greece and Italy and, you know, where there are legitimized rituals and, you know, people wear black and they cover mirrors for very long periods of time. And it's a kind of culturally legitimized way of saying you are in a very different mode and it's normal to be in this mode. We are honoring the loss. And I'm sure it's much easier for people when it's kind of socially kind of legitimized in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, basically it's accepted and it's understood that you're in a compromised position in your life, that basically you won't be as efficient, you're not going to be as good of an employee, you're not going to be at the top of your game, that you are grieving. And grieving is really, I consider it a job almost, you know. It takes that much energy, that much time, that much dedication. It's really, they call it grief work, and it really is work, and it takes a lot of courage and a lot of attention. And most people don't get support for that. If anything, they're getting the opposite message from their friends and family, who mean well, and yet they say virtually the wrong thing by saying, you know, you need to buck up, you need to get back on the horse, you need to get back into life, oh, it's not that bad. They try to minimize and even take away the pain, and that is not the way to heal.
Right. I want to ask you about that a little later. An appropriate, helpful role for loved ones. But I'm wondering if you could speak first to the whole, I mean, you formulated a transcending loss model in the book. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about, I mean, you started to talk about that, about what you see as the stages of loss in this model and how they may be different from current thinking, like, you know, some of Kubler-Ross's stuff. You talked in the book about shock, disorganization, reconstruction, synthesis, and transcendence. And I'm wondering if you could just speak very briefly about that so that our listeners could have a sense of what, you know, I know you're saying it's not linear, obviously, but what would be expectable kind of stages through this process?
Right. Well, in general, you mentioned the Kubler-Ross model, and that was a five-stage model that was very popular and still is very popular, although it essentially was meant to describe the experience of dying patients. Mm-hmm. She didn't actually mean it to be for grieving, but so and that particular model, which begins with denial and ends with acceptance, is often considered the end point, that acceptance somehow is the end. What is different about the transcending loss model is that the first three kind of mimic Kubler-Ross, and mm-hmm. when I say the first three, I call mine shock, disorganization, and reconstruction. And reconstruction is basically learning how to live in the world without your loved one. But then my model went on with synthesis and transcendence, which is basically taking her idea of acceptance mm-hmm. further. It's what happens when you keep living. And so for me, I describe it as synthesis, which is basically integrating the loss into your life, this idea that you're learning to live with the loss. It's now a part of who you are. And transcendence, which we can talk more about later, but that's really the idea that you have a choice, an intentional decision to use your pain in a productive way.
Mm-hmm.
But the shock and the disorganization and reconstruction describe what's known as acute grief.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say acute grief, I'm usually referring to the first year or two after a major loss. And that's when you move from the shock, which is basically a kind of self-protection, of denial, of everything feeling like a dream or like you're in a fog. And then disorganization is when you kind of move out of that fog and you start to settle into the intense pain. For some people, that comes fairly quickly, and for many people, it comes in the second year. And this is what's interesting. A lot of people will think, oh, I just need to get through the first of everything,
mm-hmm.
like the first anniversary, the first holiday season, and come around to the one-year mark, and then everything's going to be better. Well, in fact, often things get worse. Things start to really get intense around the 13th and 14th month because they've moved past one of the levels of shock and into a deeper level of recognition that, wow, this is for real. My loved one is not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
So that can really throw people. But in the midst of all that is this sense of reconstruction, and reconstruction is starting to learn how to live on the planet without your loved one,
mm-hmm.
without their physical presence. And I stress that because even though their physical body, their form is gone, there's still very much a relationship that's in place. And the reason for that is because love does not die. Love never dies. And when I say this, I'm talking about the death of a loved one as opposed to other kinds of losses, such as divorce or a job loss or a house burning down. And we can talk about those, how they might mm-hmm. compare to death. But in the sense of the loss of a loved one by death, there's this sense that, yes, you've lost their form, but you're still in relationship with them. You're still thinking about them frequently. I recommend keeping pictures up. I don't think there's anything pathological about understanding that you are still in a relationship with this person.
And I think so many people are given so much feedback to the contrary. They're told, you're dwelling, it's morbid, they're gone, you need to let go. And that puts people
exactly.
in such a bind.
Oh, it does, because they don't want to, and they're being told it's pathological. But you know what? They can't do that anyway, because when someone is imprinted into your heart and soul, you can't just cut them out. You can't pretend like they didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So I really try to help people understand that they can do that in a healthy way, that you move forward in your life and you bring them with you. It's not a matter of moving on and leaving that relationship behind, that you can still choose to love, to embrace life, to move forward and bring them with you and have their love inspire you and have this experience enrich your life in a way that you might not ever have imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what synthesis and transcendence are about. It's the what happens 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years later. How do you move forward and bring that loved one with you?
Okay. Now, I'm thinking about some clients I've worked with in the past who lost a child. I'm also thinking about a client I work with who, she lost an older son, a son who was away at college and died. And, the way they try to kind of honor that person and hold that person in their heart was to leave everything in their room exactly as it had been. While they still moved on with their life and they went on, you know, some of these couples went on to have other children, they participated in life. And I'm wondering, would you say that there's a point at which holding that person in your heart and trying to honor them in you know, creating like a shrine to that person, would see as in any way dysfunctional?
Well, I think it depends on the situation. I mean, as a blanket rule, I would say it's not necessarily dysfunctional, even though there are many in our culture who would, in fact, say it is dysfunctional. And yet you have other cultures that routinely have shrines to their deceased, to their mm-hmm. ancestors. There's nothing unusual about it. And so the way I try to look at it is in the context of the life. So if I had a family, let's say, who kept a room intact for a deceased child, and all the other children, you know, don't have their own room, they're cramped, everyone is tripping over each other, and no one's allowed to use this spare room, and furthermore, the mother maybe stopped working, became alcoholic, you know, you have all other signs mm-hmm. of dysfunction, mm-hmm. I would say that could be a problem. On the other hand, if you have a family that seems to be working reasonably well and the parents are moving forward with their life and everyone has enough space and there's plenty of room to have an extra bedroom that's left intact, I don't see a problem with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's how it's the larger context of how it's fitting into their life,
exactly.
how they're managing their life with this. And how much life may stop or be on hold around it, it sounds like.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
those are the points, the indicators that you want to look at as to whether it's healthy or not.
Okay.
But in general, I would say, you know, people shouldn't be afraid to have reminders out, to have pictures up, to have objects that they loved or, you know, trophies of children that are no longer here that they won a soccer match or, you know, again, the people that want to shut all that away are the ones usually that are most uncomfortable with pain.
Yes, yes, yes.
And those indicators, those memories, they're sort of like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they can create some pain and cause people to cry or to feel sad. But on the other hand, and especially as time goes on, those memories, those photos, those indicators, they bring joy, too. There's mm-hmm. a real important shift in the grieving process when the memories start to bring more joy than sadness. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shift is possible when you essentially are honoring the pain and letting it move.
Mm-hmm. You know, so obviously people tuning in, loved ones tuning into that process, you know, and recognizing that people need to hold that person in their heart and keep them alive in their heart, that's just part of the deal. Sounds like it feels really critical. Mm-hmm. And it certainly sounds like that's one thing that anyone whose partner or loved one has experienced a loss really needs to understand, to not push them along or negate that process of holding that person in their heart, whether it's through rituals or, you know, certain visuals or whatever it is. It sounds like that's really critical. Now, I'm wondering if you could speak to, if you could say a little bit more about transcendence. You said something to the effect that it's being intentional in making a decision to grow with this loss. And I'm wondering if you could describe to our listeners what that might look like.
Well, I would say in the book I actually identify four pathways, and they happen to comprise the acronym SOAR, which is SOAR. It stands for Spirituality, Outreach, Attitude, and Reinvestment. And these are ways, and I'll describe each one just briefly, but they are ways that people take their pain and decide to grow. And I do use the word intentional because I think that it's such a painful process to grieve someone that you loved who's no longer here, that if you're not careful, if you don't make the choice, it really will shut your heart down. And again, as we talked about earlier, that may be part of the initial process, but you don't want to stay there. You don't want to be stuck there indefinitely. So the idea is to basically say, I'm going to choose to make this matter. I'm going to choose to turn my pain into something that makes a difference. So of those four pathways, spirituality is one in which your faith or your spiritual beliefs can become stronger and deeper than they had ever been. And for some people, this is a real journey because it may not be that way at first. They may be very angry at a higher power. They may lose their faith altogether. But if they stick with it, if they keep their minds open, and that's a big part of the choice of transcendence, even if you're not quite there yet, it's just to say, I remain open to the possibility that this can result in some growth. Or I remain open to the possibility that I'm going to be shown a way in which I can channel my pain that will help other people. So a lot of it is about being open and being curious. And but I think when one is open and curious, that their faith can become richer and deeper in a level that I don't think is even possible until you've had a tragedy. That it
what
really
about
does
somebody,
make your faith stronger.
What about mm-hmm. somebody who's an atheist? Somebody who doesn't have any belief in a higher power. I mean, where would you see them in this process of transcendence?
Well, then they wouldn't take the S route. They might go to the O route. So we'll go to that. And so not everyone has that faith. Get deeper. I will say, though, that in my experience, that the people who have spiritual faith do have a much easier time of this idea of growing and transforming.
I would think so.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. But not everyone has it, so it's not the only route, but it does make things easier. So a second route, which would be outreach, you don't have to have a spiritual faith to necessarily go down this particular pathway, but again, it does make it easier. But outreach is basically deciding to help other people. And often it's helping other grievers or other people who are suffering, perhaps other patients, cancer victims, people through hospice. Often it takes the form of becoming a volunteer, starting a foundation, starting some sort of mission where you're particularly reaching out to people to help them. And sometimes it's not as big as a mission like that. It might just be that you attend grief groups and you feel like part of your purpose is to help other people, and then suddenly you start to run grief groups, that you have this idea that you are going to take your pain and connect to other people who have a similar pain or mm-hmm. some kind of pain that you can understand. And it is true that grievers understand pain in a way that non-grievers typically don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's almost like they become grief counselors just by on-the-job training.
Oh, absolutely.
And A is for attitude, and that has to do with really opening yourself to seeing life differently and seeing death differently. Frequently, grievers will say they no longer fear death. They might have a sense of savoring life in a new way, of having a perspective on the small stuff and the big stuff that sort of quote-unquote other normal people don't have, a real prioritization that just little stuff doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you've got, you know, stress at work. These things are small. It's like don't sweat the small stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real ability to see more clearly what matters in life, which really is love and relationships, and that the other stuff is not so important at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so there can be a real attunement and heightened sense of the attitude that life is important, life is brief, don't take it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last path is reinvestment, which is similar to the outreach, but it may not be specifically about helping people, but reinvesting in some mission or cause that gives your life purpose. And that could even be artistic expression or writing songs or writing poetry, finding some way to reinvest in your life. It could be loving grandchildren. It could be having a pet. But it's basically a conscious decision to reinvest your energy in the people and pets and projects on this planet that bring you alive and give you some purpose.
So it's a very active process.
It's a very active process. Yes,
It is.
There's intentionality, and it's not the same for everybody. You know, it could look very different from one griever to the next.
You know, it's such a kind of wonderful way of looking at how loss doesn't have to be something that just happens to you that you have to somehow swallow. It's in your frame, it's an active process of being very intentional, making decisions and making choices about how you're going to move forward with it.
That's right, because the loss did happen to you, but now your control is how are you going to respond to it and what are you going to do because of
right.
it.
Well, that gets to my next question. I thought about this a lot before our show. Do you see all loss as the same? So if you lose a partner by suicide, or if you lose a child by murder rather than death, or if you lose a partner by divorce, and that one comes to mind because I've worked with clients who have said to me, it would have been so much easier if my wife had just died or if she had just gotten hit by a truck than if she had left me. And I'm wondering, do you see the process of dealing with loss as the same regardless of the method of loss?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question. And, of course, the answer is yes and no. It's basically... Mm-hmm. There's a core underpinning of the experience of loss that is universal, and I'll say more about that in a minute, but I guess let me address the differences first, which is that each kind of loss does have its own particular issues to deal with, that they are very, very different, and they are very, very much the same. The differences are subtle and yet not subtle, because death by suicide is very different than a death by cancer, and divorce is very different than a murder. I mean, they really are different, and they have peculiarities to each scenario, whether one evokes more guilt or the other evokes more anger or the other evokes more desire for retribution. So they are all different, but the core underpinning that I want to stress that in fact is the same for all is that basically there's a door that closes and you have to feel the effects of that door closing. And then you have to look for what door is going to open.
Mm-hmm.
So that psychological process is the same no matter what the loss, whether it's a child growing up and just going off to college, or the aging process, or, you know, changing jobs. There's this sense of a door has closed, and now you're on this sort of hinge, and now you have to figure out what door is going to open.
Okay.
But, so that's the sort of psychological underpinnings to all kinds of loss, but then you have these particularities and these idiosyncrasies that make each loss very unique. And not only the uniqueness of cancer versus murder versus divorce versus job loss, but the uniqueness of each person going through it, given their personality and their history of loss as a child and their genetic makeup and, you know, all the factors that go in, that there's just no single loss that's exactly like another, and yet there is this psychological core.
Mm-hmm. You know, I lost my grandfather. My grandfather fell out a window when he was I think he was in his late 80s, and there was such a sense of horror around dying that way. An old man had been cleaning the window, and the horror of it, and it so imprinted on me and my sisters And it left me wondering about that question. You know, I really have wrestled with that question on and off. Would it have felt really different? And it sounds like you're saying, well, yeah, we wouldn't have had to deal with the issue of the violent death. And
right.
How horrible, what an awful way to die, and the compassion for him around that. But it sounds like you're saying the core task is the same, to somehow recognize mm-hmm. that a door has closed and that there are choices about how you move forward, how you take that in and move forward.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And I also try to help people recognize that some deaths are, in fact, just filled with horror and trauma and tragedy. And I try to help people recognize that a person's life is more than their death. That the death may have been traumatic and dramatic and horrifying, but their life was more than the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your grandfather had a whole life full of people he loved and, you know, spouse, maybe more than one, who knows, children, grandchildren, a profession, people he cared about, that his life was so much more than that horrific death. And it's easy to sort of focus on traumatic endings, and I try to help people, again, get the perspective that their life was so much more. That was just a piece.
Right. It was a moment. It was a moment. And what we tend to do is we look back on the life in the context of the death.
Right.
Rather than the reverse, that the death
exactly.
was a moment in time in the context of an entire life. It's a very different lens.
In his case, yes. And in his case, a very long life.
Yes, 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 with a lot of joy in it. Now, I just want to take a second. We have several callers on the line. I just want people to know, remind people that if you have a question, it's really okay to ask it as we go. Feel free to press the number one and just ask Ashley. She's the expert on this subject, and she knows a lot about this, and we would welcome any questions at any point. So don't feel like you're interrupting if you have a question. Looks like there are no questions right now, but if people have them, feel free. Now, one question comes up for me. Oh, we do have a question, so I'll wait on mine. Wait 1 second here.
Okay.
Hello, caller. Would you like to just say your name and ask your question?
Yes. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Donna.
Okay.
And my question is, I lost my son, Nick, 10 months ago, and he was 34 years old, and his birthday is tomorrow.
Mm.
And it's been tough. I thought that I'm going to have a celebration for his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And
great.
He has 3 children, and we're going to make his favorite dinner, and we're going to celebrate his life.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be honest with you. I thought I would be dealing with this a little better than I am. And I'm really struggling
mm-hmm.
at
mm-hmm.
this point.
Of course you are. Of course you do. My goodness. Well, first of all, Donna, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss. And losing a child of any age is just heartbreaking and heart-wrenching. So I'm going to speak to the idea of a birthday, unless, do you have a specific question?
No, I think I'm just a little surprised at how I really have lost it, that I thought I would be a little stronger, and I'm not, and it's okay. I will
mm-hmm.
tell you this, your book has been a gift.
Mm-hmm.
I have read it twice. I have shared it with others.
Mm-hmm.
I have gotten so much from your book that
this is an
honor to be able to speak to you and to hear what you might be able to share with me.
Well, thank you, Donna. I'm so glad to hear that. I appreciate your kind words. Well, you know, I would say that you need to be really gentle and patient with yourself. And I frequently hear grievers say things like, I thought I would be better. I thought this would, you know, I would feel stronger. And I try to give the message that what you're feeling is okay, and that 10 months later is really not that long at all, that that is a drop in the bucket. And, you know, the greater society will say, 10 months, that seems like such a long time.
Yes. Yeah.
I know it's not. It's really just the tip of the iceberg. So I'm not surprised that you're having a hard time. I think it's wonderful that you're going to celebrate with your family. I'm a big believer in honoring the birthdays, wedding anniversaries, angelversaries, which is the term I use for the anniversary of the death. So I think it's great you're going to honor him and celebrate his life and the joy that he brought to you and the love that will always be part of you.
Yes.
And one thing I will often suggest to people on birthdays especially is to get a gift in his honor that you will donate to some cause in his honor.
Oh, and that's a great suggestion. Thank you.
So that you kind of get the experience sort of shopping for him, a gift in his honor, and then it's going to help someone else. And it could be a hospital, an organization you care about. It could be donating a book to a library, but something to honor him to make that day especially joyful.
That's wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. And I will do that because it will be one of your books, because I feel that that will help someone else. And that is really what I feel that I'm going to be doing through growing through this, is I'm going to help someone, because I didn't think I could breathe again, and I'm still part of the living. And so,
well, you know, Donna, you're also really modeling for his children how important it is to keep his memory alive. And if you all cry that day, that's fine.
Or laugh,
tell
laugh. Funny stories.
That's right, and just share memories and do it
Send
all
off
together.
The moon.
And
yes,
absolutely. And you're helping a new generation learn how to grieve.
Well, thank you so much. You are amazing.
You're welcome.
Your gift has been helpful, and I appreciate. You.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Donna.
So uh-huh.
We have some more questions at this point. I have another hello caller. Could you say your name and feel free to ask your question or make your comment?
Am I speaking with you?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Okay. My name is Joni. My husband died. It'll be 4 years. I know I should sound better, but
don't apologize. You never have to apologize for feeling.
Okay. One of the things that I really liked from the Transcending Loss on Facebook was when you said that you move on, but you bring your loved one with you, and that just really helped me. But my question is, when you say bringing them with you, my hope is that he really is, it's not just the memory, but he's somewhere spiritually, and that he actually spiritually is with me. We are still united, our souls, in the thing that I feel like I could survive all of this if I had the hope that he was, you know, seeing his grandkids and his kids, and that I will be with him again, and that also that when he did die, he was such a good man, and he had so much faith that when he left, that he actually was greeted by the Lord, and that he is experiencing joy somewhere.
Well, you know, Joni, I absolutely believe those things are true. I do believe in a spiritual realm. I believe he's at peace, and I believe he can watch over you. And, of course, I can't prove those things, but it's kind of a leap of faith that you're right. You have him with your memories, you have him in your heart, and you have his spirit that's around you and with you always. So I would say hold on to those beliefs. There's no reason to not believe them. They will comfort you, and it will make your time here easier until you can be with him again.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Best of
You're
luck
welcome.
To you. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.
We have another caller with a question. Hello, you're on the air. Can you say your name and what your question is?
Actually, Susan, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, actually, I'm so moved by the past two callers that I'm unable to ask my question right now. So maybe perhaps later in the program.
Okay. Has what Ashley and I have been talking about been helpful to you to kind of think of it in this frame, the whole issue of loss and grieving?
Very.
Good.
Mm.
Good.
Well, you know, thank you for your call. I know what she means. This material is so moving because it's just so deep. It's so profound. And part of that is because love is just the most amazing force in this universe. And I think it's just worth repeating over and over again that when the person you love is gone, it doesn't mean that the love dies. The love is still so much with them, with all of us. And that's part of the fuel of how to make meaning, is that you are inspired by the love and you continue to live in honor of them while you're still here on this planet. So,
well,
all
actually,
right.
What'd
you
say?
Did you get your wind back?
Yeah, kind of, but my question seems almost insignificant in view of the past two calls and frivolous, because my grief is not for someone who's died, but for somebody who's living, who went through a devastating illness, and that person is no longer the same person whom I once knew.
Mm-hmm.
So I grieve for the loss of what once was, and I don't even know if it comes under the same category, and I feel very self-absorbed and selfish even mentioning it.
Well, I wouldn't feel that way if you can talk yourself into being patient and kind with yourself, because that is absolutely the exact same kind of loss. Someone whom you loved and knew is no longer the same person. This happens with Alzheimer's. This happens with severe illnesses. It's basically a closing of one door and an opening of another. And in fact, this is true for parents watching their children grow up, and they haven't died, but they're not the same people anymore. They're not,
right,
say, sweet little children. I remember once giving a talk, and I was describing this process, and a woman came up to me, and she said, "My child is still alive, but she's a teenager, and I feel the grief that you're describing, because she's not my sweet little girl anymore. Now she's this ornery, difficult teenager." And I actually, now that I have teenagers, I know exactly what she meant. So that kind of process, it's very real and very emotional, even if the person is still alive. And in fact, sometimes because there's this subtle distinction, you do feel almost a guilt, almost a reluctance to admit how painful it is. But it's very much the exact same kind of grief, and you basically have to embark on the same process.
Well, what if you don't want to open door number two?
Well, it may take time. It may take time. So, yeah, it's a journey. That's what I tell people. This is a journey, and every day will bring a new feeling. And what you're feeling today is not exactly what you'll feel tomorrow or the next day. Feelings are in flux, they're in motion, and you want to try to honor the journey.
Oh, that's good advice. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank
you're
you,
welcome.
Paula. Thank you very much. I'm looking at the time now, and, you know, we could go on and on with this. Ashley, we may have to do a redo here,
okay,
a part two show, because this is such a compelling topic that, you know, everybody relates to. I'm wondering what you would see as the most useful role for loved ones, beside what you've already said, kind of being patient and allowing, and not sort of forcing a process that isn't, you know, having preconceived notions about what the process would be. But what would you see as the most useful role for the loved one of somebody who's lost, somebody who's experienced a loss?
Well, I would say sharing memories is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And not being afraid. I've often heard people say, well, I don't want to bring up, you know, so-and-so because it's going to upset her or make her cry. And I say, bring them up. It's okay if she cries. She's thinking about him anyway. Share mm-hmm. your memories. Share your reflections, your thoughts. So don't be afraid to share feelings and emotions with someone. And if they start to cry, then you hold them, you hug them, you hold their hand, you cry with them. People love to hear memories, to know that their loved one isn't forgotten. So the best gift you can give to a griever is to ask them how they're feeling and really listen to the answer and share memories about their loved one, because they are very much thinking about that person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And nobody wants to feel that a life is forgotten.
Mm-hmm. So
and
it really validates. I'm sorry?
It validates. And I was just going to say, and to keep tracking through time, not to assume, oh, it's been 5 years, they must be over the loss. No. 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you continue to say, you know, I was thinking about George or Sue or whoever it was, and I know it's been X number of years, to keep reminding them that you remember.
I think that's such an important point, Ashley, because I know so many people have had the experience that they're surrounded with love and validation and sharing around the immediate loss. And then everybody moves on and seems to have forgotten the fact that it's still very much, very much there for the person who's experienced the loss. We have all these rituals, funerals and wakes and sitting Shiva and, you know, all these wonderful rituals that honor the loss and kind of hold that person. But so often people feel so forgotten, in the aftermath.
That's right. That's right. And yet they're living with the loss every single day.
Yeah.
They're living and they're learning how to continue to grow, but they never forget, and nor should they.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't believe this, but we only have 4 minutes left, and I'm going to have to end the show. I would love for you to come back, Ashley, because I have questions about, and I'm sure listeners do, about children and grieving when a child has experienced a loss, and questions about couples grieving differently, and we're just not going to be able to get to it. I'm wondering,
be
willing?
We were going to talk about couples. That's right.
I'm going to ambush you here. Would you be willing to? Well, it didn't have to be. It's inherently about relationships. And when you talk about the role for loved ones, that's part of what one does in a couple. Would you be willing? Here's a little ambush question, to come back for a part two, because I think there are so many more questions that we could address and so many more issues that you could really share your wisdom around. How's that for
you? I'd be more than happy to. Absolutely.
You can't say no. Okay. Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Ashley. I really enjoyed this show, and I've learned a lot, and I'm sure, listeners have, it's obviously been very meaningful to the people who are on the line. There are lots of people on the line, people who didn't ask questions, and I want to thank you, listeners, for tuning in, and if you would like more information about this issue or contact, go to AshleyDavisBush.com or should they call you at your New Hampshire office, Ashley?
Yeah, my phone number is actually on the website under the contact tab,
yeah.
So they can email me or call me. Yeah,
okay.
That's the way to reach me.
Okay, that's 603-734-5050. And for grief, stress, or intimacy support, I would recommend that you check out Ashley Davis Bush on Facebook. And your Facebook page is just that, Ashley Davis Bush?
No, I actually have three different pages. So one is you type in transcending loss, one is shortcuts to inner peace, and one is shortcuts to intimacy.
Okay,
so
that's great.
Some people are on all three sites and others are just on one. But I do post frequently.
And those are great because those are support, those are interactive sites where people can get support and post questions and wrestle with issues, and there's you know, there's feedback for them. So, you know, I would recommend that anybody go there. So once again,
thank you, Susan. Appreciate
it. I really enjoyed this. Now, for our listeners, tune into my next episode on Wednesday, March 7th at 8:30 p.m. when I'll have an open mic session with listeners about a very relevant relationship issue, which I'll announce very soon on Facebook, Twitter, and on my blog at susanlager.com. It's still sort of in formulation. I have lots of ideas, and once again, I'm trying to decide among all the things, you know, what I'll be discussing. So do tune in. And in the meantime, I really appreciate your being here and look forward to you coming on again. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.